Welcome to the Public Morality. Who was Martin Luther King Jr.? Perhaps the more appropriate question, who have we made him out to be in the 21st century? The individual whose birthday we celebrate on the third Monday in January has become many things to many people. In the public discourse, the portrayals of King range from an all-loving civil rights leader who preached nonviolence to radical nonconformists who gave his life appealing to the better angels of the American nature. In the 56 years since his assassination, King's words have been cajoled, truncated, and at times misinterpreted in order to provide the Martin Luther King one needs in the moment. However King is defined, he was a living individual, complete with high and low moments common to all. Author Jonathan Eich provides a salient text in his 2023 release, King, A Life. By courageously eschewing popular culture, Eich provides insight into the Martin Luther King that was, rather than the one hindsight wishes him to be. Jonathan Eich, welcome to the Public Morality.
Thanks, Byron. Good to talk to you.
I want to begin by what I define as the two Martin Luther Kings. There's the cheap king and the authentic king. The cheap version borders on perfection, distributed to mass markets. He's easy to digest, doesn't require critical thinking. And then there's the authentic version. It's more complicated, at times a walking contradiction. And it seems to me your text has added some much needed weight to the authentic side of the King scales. Your thoughts, sir?
Well, I appreciate that. I hope you're right, because that's really what I set out to do. This cheap version of King, this candy-coated, sugar-coated, watered-down version of King, really doesn't do us any good. We take the comfortable parts of King, the parts that are easy to digest, I Have a Dream, content of our character, and we forget how radical he was. We forget how religious he was. We forget how unpopular he was. And I think that's something that we need to fight back against. And I wanted to write a book that would, restore some of the truth to King's story.
Your portrayal of King, especially that 13-year odyssey beginning in 1955 and concluding in 1968, I was struck by a quote from Joanne Robinson when they were considering ministerial leadership during the 1955 bus boycott. She reportedly said, "My pastor hasn't been here long, but he can move people with his words." And I'm wondering, could we cite that passage as sort of the beginning of the King legacy?
Absolutely. Think about it. He's 26 years old. He's new in town. He's just looking to get used to his church. He's got a 2-week-old baby at home, and he's not looking to lead anything except Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. And Joanne Robinson and the other women in town, including Rosa Parks, but also people like Claudette Colvin, and they've been planning for this. They've been preparing for the moment when you might finally be able to put up a fight and boycott the buses. But they still, because of the sexism of the day, they're looking for somebody to speak and to inspire people to stay off the buses. And that's when they turn to King. And they turn to King mostly because he's new in town and he hasn't made any enemies yet. And as Mrs. Robinson said, he's a pretty good speaker. He can move people with his words. And that's really when King becomes the center of attention right then.
Before we go any further, you mentioned a name, and I'd like you to spend a little more time telling the listeners who that is. You mentioned Claudette Colvin. Who is that?
Claudette Colvin is like the beta version of Rosa Parks. She was a teenage girl who was riding the buses and refused to give up her seat when she was, refused to go to the back of the bus. And they thought about rallying right then. They thought about protesting over her arrest, but they were nervous because she was so young. And they later discovered that she was pregnant, and they just thought she might not be able to put up under the stress of a big. All that publicity and a big organized movement. So they decided to wait and see if a better case came along. And that's when Rosa Parks, provided the opportunity. But Claudette Colvin's a hero too. We should talk about her.
And just for the timeline, she refused to relinquish her seat. That was in the spring. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's right. Not that much earlier.
And then another point that I want to draw on is we sort of began this conversation with the cheap version versus the authentic version. Every step of King's 13-year odyssey, there were key people that remained largely unknown in America's historical ledger. Would you take a moment and think about some of those similar events? We've already talked about Joanne Robinson and Claudette Colvin. Think about Birmingham and Selma. Who are some of the key players that were behind the scenes that may have been instrumental in developing that authentic king?
It's so true. In every case, King is the guy who comes in and walks at the head of the march. But there are people who've been preparing for that march for a long time. There are people who've been, registering voters and preaching voter education and preaching nonviolence. And King comes in and gets most of the attention. But, in Birmingham, for example, it's Fred Shuttlesworth. There's no Birmingham protest. We may not have the Civil Rights Bill without Fred Shuttlesworth paving the way for King. He's been organizing in Birmingham since the 50s. His house has been blown up. He's ferocious, incredibly courageous, brilliant speaker. But he's the one who's also saying to King, "We need you to come to Birmingham. I can't do it alone." Only King can really deliver that national media, can really put the pressure on the government, and because he's King, he has this ability to focus the nation's attention like nobody else. But in almost every city you look at, there's somebody like Fred Shuttlesworth who's been doing the work and sort of blocking for King.
So what would you say, since you mentioned Fred Shuttlesworth, what would you say was, say, the difference between the Birmingham campaign in 1963 and the precursor to Birmingham, which would have been Albany, Georgia? What was different about those two efforts? Because they both brought in King, they both were protesting. Why the different results?
Well, Albany's pretty much described as a failure for King. And some people say he failed because he didn't have, a really concrete set of demands. Some people say he failed because he was unable to get the kind of reaction from the police and the other city officials that they remained calm and they didn't overreact. They didn't get violent. And I think King learned that when he after Albany, he learned that if he's going to do this again, he needs to be more forceful. He needs to have, a more concrete set of demands, and he also needs to apply economic pressure. So when he goes into Birmingham, he's really ratcheting up. But even Birmingham isn't succeeding for a while. It's important to remember that when he gets to Birmingham, a lot of the black preachers don't want to join him from some churches. The city seems to be waiting him out. The city of Birmingham probably looked at what happened in Albany and tried to learn from that. And King, for a while is running out of people to put in jail. He's sending his people off to get arrested. Fill up the jails becomes the strategy. But even then, he's got to recruit, kids, teenagers, because he's running out of bodies to throw at them. And it's only when the teenagers get involved that really the tide begins to turn.
And you mentioned you mentioned sort of the way that Albany waited out. So you have a Lori Pritchard who took a very, very different tack. Now, the way I see it, and I'd love for your comments here, there were sort of three sort of serendipitous moments, it seems to me, in Birmingham. One, Bull Connor wasn't Lori Pritchard. Two, Birmingham changed their charter, which made the it made police commissioner responsible to the mayor, and then the third one is television. So how do those things all come together to sort of give us the sort of serendipitous moment, sort of give us this seminal moment in American history?
Well, it's always one of those instances where you got to be the right person at the right place at the right time. And that's everything came together in Birmingham in a way that King never could have designed it. Nobody could have planned it that way. And as you said, you had to have the TV cameras there. You had to have the newspaper photographers there. So the conflict was growing and growing, and the national media was waiting. And that's when, Bull Connor loses his patience and brings out the police dogs and the water cannons. And those things are captured on national TV. And there's that famous photo of of the police dog snapping at a young black man who wasn't even a protester. He just happened to be walking by and watching. But all of that really captures the nation's attention. And it's, you know, it's that overreaction by Bull Connor that sends this message and really shocks President Kennedy into action. In fact, when Kennedy did finally agree to put forth the civil rights legislation, he said to King, Bull Connor should get the credit for this, which I'm sure must have been pretty offensive to King at the time.
No, but I take his point because I know that when I've gone through the Civil Rights Museum in Birmingham, toward the end of the exhibit, there are these papers from all over the world that show the police dogs and fire hoses. So this has an international impact, and not to mention the Cold War. So I see Kennedy's point about Bull Connor getting an assist.
Yeah, it, absolutely. And, you know, your point about the Cold War is a great one, because part of why Kennedy responded was that he was trying to prove that America was and democracy were better than communism and better than the Soviet Union. And it's embarrassing to have your own citizens being treated this way. And suddenly, you know, King is able to put more pressure on Kennedy and on the federal government by saying, you want to prove that democracy is the greatest system in the world. You want to prove that America is the greatest country on earth. Well, then show the world that you're treating people here well. And you won't need to make that argument so much. It'll be obvious to the world that this is that democracy treats everybody better.
Something else about the text that I really appreciated was the treatment that you gave Coretta. That, I mean, you really went into, you know, not only her indispensable role in King's life, but also you made her three-dimensional. She just was not somebody who was just in a reactionary space to whatever Martin was doing. You presented her in a three-dimensional light. Talk about that. I mean, how did you make the decision to make her so prominent? I thought it was well done.
Well, I think, thanks, but I think she made the decision, and I was just following the facts. You know, she is a force to be reckoned with, and she's been overlooked. She still hasn't had a proper biography. She definitely deserves one. And what happens is she gets overlooked because she's required to stay home and raise the kids. And King never really overcomes his own sexism and continues to tell her that her job is to stay home and raise the kids. But she nevertheless, you know, remains a vital force. King falls in love with Coretta because she's an activist, because she's got more activist credentials than he does, you know, when they first met. And then even throughout their marriage, even when she was told that she had to stay home and take care of the kids, she's pushing him and guiding him and suggesting, for example, when he wins the Nobel Peace Prize, that they both have a greater responsibility now to speak out on issues like apartheid and on war. And she's speaking out on the Vietnam War more aggressively than he is in the beginning. So I think that even though he was, limited in his feminism, to put it mildly, she wasn't taking it. She was continuing to really push, and she made a huge impact, and she knew it too. So even while she was being, you know, treated poorly, she knew her own importance.
Well, when I read your text, you know, obviously when we're reading history, we one should always try to keep people in their context in the world that they lived in, and not through the enlightened lens of our 21st century understanding. I'm being tongue in cheek on the enlightened part there. But with that said, how do we negotiate because the authentic king, you know, had his sexism. The authentic king, strayed in his marriage. How do we negotiate those unsavory parts of the authentic king?
Well, you know, I was worried that people wouldn't want to read about the king's flaws, that he, you know, he strayed from his wife and he cheated, on his doctorate. He plagiarized extensively. He suffered from mental health concerns. You know, he was depressed. He attempted suicide twice as a teenager. But, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge those moments of weakness and failure, because he's human. And, you know, it doesn't do us any good to expect perfection out of our heroes, because nobody's perfect, and we can't have any heroes if that's our if that's our requirement. So I've been really pleasantly surprised, you know, that people reading the book actually seem to admire him more when they see him presented in his, you know, full complex humanity, you know, warts and all.
You know, it's funny you mentioned timing earlier, because I remember what was about 20 years ago, maybe more than that, when Ralph Abernathy penned his text and alluded to the fact that Martin had strayed even the night before his assassination, and people took a very, very different tack, probably more vested in the cheap version at that time. So I'm glad to hear you've gotten that type of response. You know, one of the things I have to admit, even in my 21st century lens and trying to account for the time, I was really, I kind of got upset with Martin one time in your telling was after the keynote address at the March on Washington, when Coretta wanted to meet President Kennedy because he had called her several times, and Martin wouldn't, you know, he's like, no, it's, you know, you have to be vested. And I was sort of like, come on, Martin, how do you rationalize that? So your thoughts about that, if you would, sir.
Yeah, the March on Washington is a low point. It's his highest point, obviously. It's his most famous moment, I Have a Dream speech. But it's a low point in many ways because he specifically says no when they suggest that women should be given speaking slots on the program. And no women are given main speaking slots that day. And then when it's over and Coretta is there and says, I want to go to the White House too. I've spoken to President Kennedy on the phone. Martin says, no, you're not on the guest list. Well, come on. You know, he could have showed up there and said, this is my wife, Coretta. Nobody was going to turn her away. He knew that. And it's just, it's sad. You know, you'd think that he would have been proud to have her along, but you know, there's no accounting for these kinds of things, and who knows what was going through his head. And, you know, again, it's a different age, a different era, and nobody else was bringing their wives. So maybe he just thought it was, you know, wasn't the woman's place, but it was a disappointment for sure.
Yeah, well, none of the other wives had been called when their husbands were in trouble by the President of the United States. So
that's right. And he was Martin Luther King. He was the head honcho. He was the, you know, the guy that Kennedy was, he was probably on the top of the guest list. So he could have invited it. He could have had an ad one if he wanted one.
Right. Oh yeah. Right. As you wrote, when he walked in, when the whole group walked in, Kennedy was saying, I have a dream. I have a dream. So yeah, I think he could have got away with having his wife there. Definitely. Talk about King's relationship with his father as you presented it. I found it quite revealing. You know, it impacted the type of preacher the King would be, his sort of preference for conflict avoidance, at least outwardly. Say more about the influence of his father in his life.
Oh, it's so important. And Daddy King is just one of the most fascinating figures in American history. And, you know, he's born into sharecropping. His grandparents were enslaved. His parents were born into slavery. He just walks off the farm at the age of 12, leaves Stockbridge, makes his way to Atlanta, learns to read and write, marries into this preacher's family, and comes from nothing really to create this family of royalty, of potential, of you know, extraordinary achievement. And he's also really domineering, really stubborn, and Daddy King, as everybody calls him, you know, scares a lot of folks. And I think he scares young Martin too. You know, first of all, you know, his son is named Mike at birth, and Mike King and Mike and little Mike, and Martin Luther King Sr. changes his son's name, and really, you know, puts a lot of fear into his son. And Martin Luther King Jr. could never stand up to his old man. You know, he would always avoid conflict, confrontation, and you see that in his relationship with others, with Roy Wilkins, and with even with the presidents. King does not like to get into arguments. He's always just looking to say, you know, okay, we'll talk about it. I'll think about it. You know, it's fascinating that our greatest protest leader is really not fond of conflict.
Yeah. You can even add J. Edgar Hoover to that list.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Why couldn't he tell J. Edgar Hoover to you know, get lost and, you know, and call him out. And he didn't, he just kind of, treated him politely and moved on.
You know, I was also fascinated with the comparison, the parallels you drew in a macro context between the formative years of President Kennedy along with the formative years of Martin Luther King. I had never thought about it like that. I thought it was quite fascinating. Say more about that, if you would.
Yeah, you know, they both had powerful, domineering fathers. They both had parents who were, unfaithful, and they both grew up in this with this sort of sense of privilege, with super high expectations, you know, enormous pressure on them to succeed, and they both, you know, turned out to be womanizers. So it's funny, if they had spent more time together, they might have bonded if the black white thing wasn't such a big divide for them. And it's also interesting, I always found it kind of surprising to think that Kennedy was 13 years older than Martin Luther King, because we think of Kennedy being this incredibly young president, and you think about King being even younger than that. It tells you just how, you know, really young King was when he was accomplishing all of this.
What do we do? We're going back slightly to Birmingham. You know, one of my takeaways from your text is that you talk about King's ability to make sort of these interconnections between, say, American democracy and the human condition, and to locate amorality within the bowels of an amoral paradigm. With that said, does he have anything that does that better than the letter from Birmingham jail?
Really good question. You know, one of King's superpowers is his ability to force us to look inside ourselves and to reflect on morality. And that's a hard thing to do, especially, you know, these days, everybody's sort of stuck in their positions. Everybody thinks they're right. But because King was calling on the Bible and the Constitution and saying that he felt like his job was to make sure those two documents squared, he presented this argument that was really hard to reject. And he forced people, and the whole point of that letter from Birmingham jail is to say, you know, he expects better from religious leaders. You know, nothing infuriated him more than religious leaders saying, just be patient, you know, give it time. You know, the time to do the right thing is always right. I'm paraphrasing. He said it better than I. But that letter is so powerful. And it's just an extension of the same message that he gave on his very first speech in Montgomery, that if they're wrong in demanding justice, then God is wrong. The Bible is wrong. The Constitution is wrong. So tell me those things are wrong. He's daring us, really.
Yeah. No, I was really struck when you mentioned the Montgomery speech. I was really struck reading that. I'm like, this guy's 26 years old. I don't know about you, but at 26, I wasn't thinking like that.
No, I was still pretty immature at that point.
Yeah. But then again, for all of King's intellectual powers, you also present that he was someone, and these are my words, intellectually lazy, in that on several occasions he's guilty of plagiarizing large blocks of text that went undetected for many years. So how do you account for what is clearly a paradox?
Well, we're all complicated people, and King's gift was moving people. His gift wasn't writing. It never was. And he knew that. His gift was communicating and connecting. And he was a preacher. And he said that over and over again. He said, I'm not a civil rights leader by training. I'm a preacher. And the civil rights leadership, the activism, is just an extension of my ministry. So, yeah, he plagiarizes his dissertation. He plagiarizes some of his sermons. He even plagiarized a high school speech for a public speaking contest. But that's because he doesn't see his job as being the writer. He's not so concerned with originality. He's concerned with moving people with his words. And if he has to borrow some words to do that, he's got no problem with it. And I think some of that comes from the tradition of being a preacher. A lot of preachers were, you know, trained in the oral tradition. They hear someone else's sermon and they take up the parts they like and they use it again and make it their own. And I think that's how King was thinking about his job.
Speaking of paradox, when we think back to the grainy footage of King's keynote address at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, Which is sort of the apex of celebrating the Cheap King in particular. We forget that around that time, just a couple of days later, it's when around the clock surveillance began on the authentic king. How did this come to be that right after that speech, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover demanded the king be surveilled round the clock?
Well, it's not a coincidence. You think about it, Kingsley gives this speech that really presents a vision for the future of America, and it's televised nationally, live, tens of millions of people watching as King presents this dream, and literally people singing in harmony, holding hands, black and white people together, and we see the nation really reflecting. We see, even the mainstream white media says this might be a turning point. We might be ready to leave some of this racism behind and become a better society. And the FBI sees that as a threat. And they produce this memo that you referred to for J. Edgar Hoover that says, given King's performance, given his oratory at the mall, at the March on Washington, we must now consider him, if we have not already done so, the most dangerous man in America when it comes to race. So, and they double down on the surveillance. Why is he dangerous? Why do they consider him dangerous? It's not because they think he's a communist. It's because they think that he might force a change in the status quo, that he might unite Americans in demanding a more democratic society, and they don't want to give up that power. They've been hoarding it for a long time, and they're not ready to share. And that's why they see King as a threat.
And given that it was ultimately Attorney General Robert Kennedy who signed off on it, probably perhaps his responsibility of being his brother's keeper, can we look at that moment as anything other than a stain on the legacy of Robert Kennedy? How do we square that?
No, it's definitely a stain, and it's a stain on the entire Kennedy administration. And the stain spills over into the Johnson administration because Johnson knows that the surveillance is going on, and he's, asking King for help in passing civil rights legislation, asking King for help when Watts is on fire. And he, at the same time, he's gossiping behind King's back and listening to these tapes of from King's hotel room. It's a massive stain. These people knew that King was a partner with them in trying to fight for justice, and they still had him under surveillance, in part because they were afraid to stand up to J. Edgar Hoover, in part because they liked having information and gossiping about him, and maybe just in part because, they're racist and they don't see King as an equal. But it's a stain that just keeps spreading.
I want to go back to the Birmingham campaign for just a moment and just sort of do a historical timeline and see if this if you would consider this accurate. Well, back starting with Birmingham, but the year 1963 in particular. So that movement began with opposition by the city of Birmingham, and ostensibly they were also going up against the state of Alabama. Led by Alabama Governor George Wallace. And not long after that, they have a part of the federal government going after them by way of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. Would that be accurate for what they were dealing with in 1963?
Yeah, it's accurate. We think about King working in collaboration with the president of the United States, but really, he's not really getting much help. I think he sees his job as being a thorn in their side, and that he's just got to keep protesting and keep, risking his life and keep calling attention to the racism and the segregation that continues to dog Black Americans, and that his job is to be difficult, to be a crowbar, as Bernard Lafayette told me, that to keep prying away until he loosened something up and established a little bit more freedom.
I want to talk a little bit about the Cheap King. As you noted, King donated all the funds he received from winning the Nobel Peace Prize, but he kept the Rolex watch. Rolex has subsequently ran ads of King wearing the watch. Dodge Trucks used the Drum Major Instinct sermon during a Super Bowl ad. The Cheap King is far more profitable, at least at Madison Avenue. Did you find it a need, or did you have to extricate the cheap version in order to get at the authentic King? How did you negotiate that?
Well, I try not to focus on what's happened in recent years with his image. You know, if the family wants to sell his drum major instinct speech to sell cars and trucks, that's their decision. Even though the drum major instinct is basically saying that cars and trucks aren't what's important. We shouldn't be defined by what kind of car we drive. We should be defined by what kind of person we are and how we serve God and how we serve our community. That's the point of that speech. So it was highly hypocritical to take the drum major speech and use it to sell cars and trucks. But, you know, that aside, I think, you know, what we ought to focus on is how King's words are being misused, how people are taking his speeches and using them for cover for their own racist views, to fight back, to pull back on rights that King had fought for. You see people quoting King saying that we should be judged by the content of our character, not the color of our skin, and using that to justify their attacks on affirmative action, knowing full well that that's not what King meant. So, you know, I think we have a responsibility, and the King children do a good job of standing up when that kind of hypocrisy arises. But we, you know, we all need to, you know, fight for King and make sure his words are not taken out of context in that way.
Yeah, no, that's I know a lot of individuals right of center politically like to offer that King was a Republican, which was true, but that leaves a lot of nuance off the table to make that claim.
Yeah, and I'm not sure it's fair to say he was Republican. He never talked about his political affiliations, and he occasionally talked about who he was. He never endorsed candidates.
Well, the only reason I say that is because I got it from someone I know you're familiar with, is Claiborne Carson. And I talked to Claiborne Carson. He said the King registered as a Republican first time, and he never changed his registration, is how Claiborne Carson puts it. So,
well, that makes you someone who registered at one point, but I don't think King would have ever accepted any either party affiliation.
He exactly.
Heard about that.
Yeah, no, we're in total agreement. I'm just saying, so there's a lot of nuance there. And I think, as you point out, the closest he came to endorsing anyone, he was vehemently opposed to Goldwater.
Yes.
That was about as close as he came. And I don't see him pulling the lever for Goldwater anytime soon.
No, he felt Goldwater was enough of a threat that he needed to take a stand and come out clearly in opposition to him. And I think he also late in the Johnson administration made it clear that he would not support Johnson's reelection, given his deep involvement and his escalation of the Vietnam War.
Well, you know, I'm glad you raised that, because when you think about, and I'm using the term loosely, the partnership between King and Johnson for the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, for King to take that stand on the war in Vietnam, I mean, I can't imagine the courage that requires to stand up, because everyone, you know, white liberals, you know, the black community was telling him not to do that.
Yeah, that's right. And the war was still pretty popular at that point. He was an outlier. And he also, as you point out, you know, had this relationship with Johnson and needed Johnson, and Johnson needed him. And they had accomplished so much together. But, you know, and King's own friends and peers were urging him not to speak out so much on Vietnam, that it was hurting the cause. It was hurting the civil rights movement. But King felt like it would be hypocritical. You know, how do I call out? How do I ask for nonviolence in Detroit and Los Angeles without pointing out that the greatest purveyor of violence on earth is the American government in Vietnam, that he couldn't live with himself.
Exactly. To that extent, if you go, I know you have, going back, looking at some of the editorials that were written about King, you wouldn't think it was the same person that won Time Magazine Man of the Year in 1963. They're like two different people.
Yeah, not to mention the Nobel Peace Prize. he's being treated as if he's unqualified to speak out on moral issues and on war. And I think it's important to remember that part of the reason he's getting treated so badly in the press is that the FBI has been leaking his details of his sex life to members of the press. So King is suddenly viewed as damaged. You know, he's viewed as a hypocrite by a lot of these reporters. And even though they're not writing about his personal life, it affects their view of him and it affects the coverage that King's getting. And King can never really understand why the media is treating him so badly. And I think that's part of the reason.
If the authentic king, the one you present in your text, were dominant, would we have a holiday in his honor today?
That's a good question. You know, the inverse of that question is whether the holiday has robbed us of the authentic king. By creating the national holiday, have we deliberately and unavoidably watered down his message and focused on "I have a dream," as opposed to the first half of that speech where he talked about police brutality and income inequality and reparations? So I think you can make a really strong argument that when you turn someone into a national holiday and you build a monument and you name streets after him, you perhaps intentionally control the message of that person's life, and you turn him into somebody who's universally admired and loved. And that means you ignore the rough parts of the story and you ignore the radicalism.
You know, when I think about historical figures there, I mean, King's not the only one that has a cheap version. There's a cheap Jefferson, there's a cheap Lincoln, there's a cheap FDR, there's a cheap JFK. So it's what we do in the American historical canon is we create a cheap version for public consumption. So I don't want to suggest that my questioning is like King is somehow unique. It's just important that we do that in the American average. At least it seems to me that way.
No, it's absolutely right. We do the same thing with Muhammad Ali, the subject of my previous book. You know, we celebrate the Ali that everybody loved when he couldn't talk anymore and he lit the flame on the Olymp for the Olympics. And we forget that, you know, he too opposed the Vietnam War and was despised by most Americans and, you know, convicted of draft evasion and called a traitor. But we intentionally overlook that part of the story to make ourselves feel good about our heroes.
Well, that you the piece that you lifted up with the conversation between King and Ali and the short press conference afterwards, that was really powerful. I mean, because again, we forget how young Ali is at that time.
Yeah, that's right. And we forget that, you know, Ali and King and Malcolm X, they were often portrayed as rivals, as enemies, as antagonists, because, you know, King was about civil rights and Malcolm and Ali were about black separatism. But they were all fighting for black dignity and they recognized that they had a lot in common. And it was really the media that was trying to divide them. And, you know, one of the important discoveries I made in my research for this book was that this quote that we have from King about, you know, where he was asked what he thinks about Malcolm X. And he's quoted in Playboy magazine saying, "I think Malcolm's fiery, demagogic oratory is bringing nothing but grief to the black community." I discovered that King never said that. On the original transcript of the interview, which I obtained from Alex Haley's archive, on the original transcript, King does not say that at all. He says that, you know, "I don't think I have all the answers, that Malcolm and he have a lot in common." And he doesn't like Malcolm's calls for violence, but that aside, they seem to be moving in the same direction late in their lives, and the media was trying to constantly present them as antagonists to divide and conquer those who were fighting for black dignity.
Quick if I'm wrong, but it was Alex Haley who did the interview with King, right? The Playboy interview,
Yes,
right?
it was.
So what would motivate him to manipulate the text like that?
Well, I think it's, you know, first of all, his editors might have had something to do with it. I'm not going to put all the blame on Haley. I'll put some of it on Haley because it's his byline on the story. But I think they're interested in controversy. They're interested in conflict that, you know, that's what sells magazines. And they wanted to stir up the pot.
In your research, was there an episode where you found King disappointing? And conversely, was there something about him that may have exceeded your preconceived notions before you started this project?
Well, yeah, I found him disappointing, certainly in the way he treated women, and particularly the way he treated his wife, and There were moments where he was cautious to the point of, you can't ever really accuse him of fear because he's putting his life on the line every day. But I think some of the younger black activists were disappointed when he declined to cross the Selma Bridge, the Edmund Pettus Bridge, the first time that they expected more of him, and he was worried about violating a court order and going back to jail. But more often, far more often, I was really moved by his courage and his faith. And over again, I kept asking myself, why doesn't he just quit? He's been stabbed in the chest. He's been arrested and jailed 29 times. His home has been bombed 3 times. He's getting death threats all the time. The FBI is trying to break him and destroy his marriage and drive him to suicide. Why doesn't he just bow out, say, I'm going to take some time off and go write a book and teach some classes, and you younger guys can take it from here. But he doesn't do that. He only keeps like doubling down and really going, the route that his faith requires him to go, and saying he has to speak out not only on the convenient issues, but on everything that Jesus teaches. And that kind of faith is just mind-boggling to me over and over again, and in spite of the risk.
Yeah, no, he could have had he had a number of offers where he could have been to Riverside, New York. He could have went over to England. I mean, he could have had a much more comfortable life circa 66, 67 than what he chose. And that's an amazing point that you raise.
Yeah, and most of us would have felt like that he was totally just justified in doing that. If he'd said, "All right, I gave you 12 years. I need some time to reflect, and I'll still be engaged. I'll still be, on call. I'll be writing and advising, and maybe I'll come back and have a second act." But he couldn't do it. He couldn't even take a pause because he just felt like he was called to this work.
Now, you've written on a number of notable figures in history. People like Lou Gehrig, Muhammad Ali, Al Capone, and now King. Is there a place where these seemingly extremely different individuals, is there a place where their lives intersect? Is there a core where they have some similarity?
Yeah, for sure. I think, they're all people who challenge orthodoxy. They're all people who feel like they can make a difference. And, Capone maybe not for the better, but he sees
Difference is
his
relative, my friend. Difference is relative.
Yeah, but even Capone thinks that he's doing something for the public good, and that he's fighting an unjust law and prohibition. But I won't go into that because most everybody I've written about has been a hero. I also wrote a book about the invention of the birth control pill, and there's a great example of people who think they can change the world and have the guts to try. And that's what really what I love about most of these characters that I've been writing about. And King and Ali are great examples of that. People who somehow believe that one person can change the world, and that they're going to give it their best shot, regardless of what it costs them.
Jonathan, this is it was a great read. I enjoyed every second of it. In fact, it's 600 pages, and I was disappointed when I was finished. Like, is that it? That's all you got? the name of the book, King Alive, and our guest for the hour has been its author, Jonathan Ike. Jonathan, I want to thank you for joining me today on the Public Rally. It's been really an honor to be in conversation with you, sir.
Always great to talk to you. Thank you, Byron.
The Public Morality welcomes your comments. You can contact me at byron@publicmorality.org. That's Byron, BYRON, at publicmorality.org. You can follow me on Facebook as well as Twitter. The archive broadcast can be found on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Prime, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Those listening to the Public Morality on WSNC can also listen on an app. Using your mobile device, simply go to your application page, search WSNC 90.5, and click open to listen from anywhere. The Public Morality is produced at WSNC on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. For all of us at the Public Morality, I'm Byron Williams.